Way versus the police department. Prosecuting attorneys are MC Ren, Ice Cube.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink. Jack Spencer, Mike Malott's on.
Joining us now is Steve Hood. He is a political consultant out of the city of Detroit. He also is commentary on the Steve Hood Show. You can find out more on that on thestevehoodshow.com. And he is joining us literally from his throne over Zoom. What is that chair that you're sitting in, Steve?
Well, it's a long story. When I used to do radio, my ratings were so good, the owner of the station actually gave me this for Christmas. Because I liked his. He had one in his office. I said, I want one of those. Where do I buy it? And he gave me one. He had his guys deliver it over here, so I keep it up here in my very special thought room. It's a very special room up here.
It literally looks like a throne for our viewer or our listeners' benefit. You can't see it, but it literally looks like the back of a throne. It's amazing.
It's like the chair on Empire.
So there you go. It looks like the chair on Empire. The first thing I wanted to talk about, Steve, is disbanding the police department as part of the response to the George Floyd death and the reaction about police brutality, race relations. Did they get into trouble by using the word disband the police department?
Yes. They got into trouble with the terminology disband the police department, and then they got in trouble with the second term, which was defund the police department. Okay. Both of them sound like you're saying we're going to put an end to it. So now they've got their apologists all over the media this morning saying, well, it's not really disbanding or defunding. There's still public safety. We're just going to change how it's done. Well, they done messed up. You got Rashida Tlaib saying defund the police without a plan. She's doing that. This is our congresswoman. Okay, from the 13th district saying defund, but no plan on actually how to do it. Now in Detroit, yeah, we ought to defund something. We ought to take half the police chief's salary and throw it in to youth services. Okay, I'd be happy with that defunding. But other than that, you've got to force substantive change. Minneapolis, Minnesota, they're gonna defund the police department, but they don't know how yet. They don't know how, what they're going to do. What that does is that throws the ball back into Donald Trump's court where he says law and order,
mm-hmm.
You know, because he finally gets something to jump on and say law and order. When people say defund the police. And he can actually put an ad out now saying they want to defund the police. I'm about law and order.
Yeah, there's always this risk, Jack, about going a little too far. You know, you get the public sentiment behind you. And then you just push it just a little too far. It kind of seems like that's where we're at with this.
I think this is what took place in this particular case. Nationally, I noticed that some of the more, shall we say, the left-leading networks kind of backed away and didn't quite want to cover some of what was going on as much, because I think they had the realization that exactly what Steve was alluding to, this at a certain point starts actually playing in favor of your opponents if you go too far. The message that comes through, I think people keep bringing up, wow, you know, suddenly 1968 has broken out in 2020. Well, take a look at what happened in 1968. People remember it was a close race between Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon. But if you add up totally the law enforcement vote and throw in George Wallace, who, if anything, was even stronger backing of law and order, et cetera, with that, just an overwhelming reaction to the what seemed to be anti-law enforcement, sort of a anarchy type of a situation. And wisely, I think the other side is saying, look, no, we don't even want to dip a toe into that. That goes places that you don't want it to go at all.
But they've already dipped a toe into it, and that's why everybody's trying to do the step back apology tour this morning.
John, any thoughts on this particular subject?
Despite the miswording, I guess you could say, there is a lot of room to talk about what we spend on police. I remember it was an issue that bothered me when I was at Michigan State University, and the university was part of the Tri-County Area Narcotics Squad, so they received huge amounts of forfeiture funds that never got oversaw. I mean, they had a retina scan machine They wrote tickets out of $45,000 SUV Suburbans. You look at, there are other instances of police where they just have kind of equipment that probably never gets used, but is very expensive. We're spending federal resources and sharing troops, supplies, and tank with local police. So there's a lot of room to talk about. I just think they got out ahead of themselves and stepped on their own message.
Steve, who do you see as providing leadership during this particular time in history? Who have you seen is doing a good job as far as trying to get in front of this movement? Who's not doing a good job?
Well, I tell you what, if we look, let's start locally. The two guys that are trying to get in front of this the best, and they're actually doing a decent job, love them or hate them, is Mike Duggan and Chief Craig. They're getting ahead of this thing. They're policing and governing accurately during this situation. And it's a very hard situation because it's more than a hydra. It's multiple heads and sometimes spontaneous things that is not under anybody's control. And that's what makes this whole situation very interesting. You've got a, it's like a community force. The internet has spread all these people, has got all these people up and down the state doing it. And it's the same way in Detroit. So if you got a movement that causes a march in Howell, okay, lovely Howell, where I feel so welcome. This is something that can't be controlled. In Detroit, if you were going to say a named person that's really in control, you don't know. The first protest was actually started by Miko Williams of Hydrate Detroit, the guy that's been pushing to get people's water on, and Joanna Underwood, the charter commissioner. She's the charter commissioner that got 60,000 votes with only a 10,000 piece mailing that she was a part of. The rest is all internet. They actually set up the first protest at police headquarters. And after that, that was hijacked by a local politician and some other community activists, and they just went louder, okay? And they've made sure that they were at every other event. It is so bad that the traditional go-to people had to have their own rally to try and be relevant. And that was the rally you saw come down Woodward, where you saw the picture in the paper of Bishop Ellis standing next to Governor Whitmer. Wendell Anthony was there. You know, you had Benny Napoleon, all them walking down Woodward and whatnot. But what you had in Ellis and in Wendell Anthony, you had the has-beens, the used-to-bes. They aren't leading this. And I feel for Governor Whitmer because she doesn't know who to talk to. The people that helped get her into office are basically irrelevant in this fight, okay, in this whole thing. So nobody knows who to talk to. The media is like focusing on certain people who are the loudest, like this Tristan guy. Nobody knows who he is, okay? Nobody knows how big his following is, all right? The only quantifiable people you actually had out there that are not electeds are Joanna Underwood and Miko Williams. Those are the only ones that you can really quantify right now. Everybody else, it's all scattershot. And that's the problem with this whole movement. What is the end game? See, back when you had the SCLC leading things back in the early days, they had an end game. They were a definable force that the people in power could meet with. Now you do not have that. You don't have a central coordinating body of the protesters.
That seems to be a real problem here, Jack. I mean, so if you're the governor or the legislature and you want to react to what they're doing, you want to appear sensitive, what the heck do you do when you have a kind of this nameless, faceless entity that's demanding change? Who do you negotiate with?
Well, I don't know if you have to negotiate. I think your position is going to be fairly clear. You're going to be in favor of the sentiment behind it. You're going to be in favor of the lawful demonstrations. You're going to be against the looting and other things along those lines. But, you know, can you possibly steer the debate into something that actually may matter, like, okay, what is the problem here where there was a police officer like this in Minneapolis with his past record of all the problems and all the disciplinary situations, and he still has his job after all that time? Can you turn this from just a sort of a blind, we're angry, to let's look into what actually happened here. And obviously, there was a problem if this person was still had that job. I would say that that would be the thing you do as well as you get it. Start the conversation and actually point out what the specific problem was, not just a mad anger. We're just very upset, but okay, what actually happened in this situation and what might we do to change that in the future? And I think something with what John said about all the other police agencies. Well, if there were fewer of those, would it be easier to get rid of somebody like this because you have more candidates for his position? Just there are substantive things you can talk about, but you got to get the tone calmed down first.
During this whole COVID-19 situation, John, it feels like the legislature has become more and more irrelevant. Now, they've tried to get into this debate last week by doing the police training legislation. They moved that in lightning speed. It seems like that, but it seems like that's the best that they can do at a very tumultuous time.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, they're exactly where they were a month ago or 2 months ago. The most significant things they've done, other than that police training bill and the resolution the Senate passed, was enshrining some of the things that Gretchen Whitmer came up with during the lockdown. Their only response seems to be that lawsuit. And other than that, they just don't seem to be playing a very significant role in anything right now.
Now, they are doing a press conference here dealing with the nursing homes and trying to draw attention to the fact that the administration's reaction to trying to get people treated for COVID-19 was to move them out of hospitals and put them into nursing homes where they could relieve some stress, I guess, on the hospitals and put them in a facility that isn't as intensive as a hospital. But then you put people who have a contagious disease in with a population of people who are most at risk of dying from it. And nowhere is this more prevalent than in the city of Detroit, Steve.
Only boneheaded move. My next door neighbor, I mean, he was old. He had dementia. He was in an Ambassador nursing home. There was no way he should have died of COVID-19. Okay? No way. It's just by moving the sick people in there that you do that. I mean, I don't understand that move. Okay, and you know, I'm one of Gretchen Whitmer's biggest fans, but that move baffles me. I wanna go back to one point before we dive into this totally. You know, she set up this minority task force for the COVID-19 thing because minorities were disproportionately affected by COVID-19. I think the governor needs to morph that task force into fighting systemic racism all throughout the state. Because it's the same issue, the whole poverty issue, the racism issue, it played into the African Americans being more susceptible to COVID-19. That little task force, that thing that she put together, I guess Garland Gilchrist is handling it, is more important now than ever. That's her response, if they can actually come up and make substantive change. But how can they do that when you have a Republican legislature, unless the soccer moms come out and say, we want this change.
Well, I want to get Jack's take on that because it seems like this would be an issue that Republicans could get on board. They were on board with getting some implicit bias training and mental health screening training in for these police officers, and they want to do it as part of a continuous effort. It seems like if there was something sensible that they could agree to, the Republicans should be all over this, shouldn't they?
Well, I can see where they could do it to some extent. I don't know how that I just honestly don't know how the stats work on that. I've heard several different things, that there are also these problems that we saw. We've seen statistics for years on the African-American population, higher diabetes, higher hypertension. But one of the more interesting ones was a comparison that I saw on Hoover, which one of the less talked about groups that also is having higher numbers than they should represent are Jews. And one of the more interesting angles somebody was taking on that was the networking. So this is really kind of a nasty thing because it's taking a positive cultural trait, which is both Jews and African Americans generally have more people in their lives on a weekly basis that they are close to, that they visit, that they consider as part of their lives. Most people would say this is a positive cultural trait until you get to a pandemic. Now that positive trait turns into a negative one. I think these are the kinds of things we have to talk about first and find out, okay, how can we separate what happened, you know, as far as how the pandemic was handled? How do we discover what did and didn't cause problems? All of these things should be discussed. I am completely on board with Steve. I think the whole nation, I believe New York also, was New York the other one that put positive COVID patients in with negative ones also in their nursing homes? I'm just astounded by that. I've yet to get a real clear understanding of how they did that.
I would add to that,
yeah,
that
Mike.
We had the TCF center with hundreds of beds that went unused. So why were they being routed to nursing homes instead of to the TCF center? I never understood why that didn't see higher use. I'd like to hear a better explanation of that.
Or the place in Novi, too, for that matter.
Well, I don't think that was actually fully set up, but the TCF center was. That was up and running.
It seems like that would make a lot more sense. A couple other things I want to touch on. John, I want to get your take here on how John James has done responding. It seems like, John, that John James has once again decided not to talk to the media about his impressions on the George Floyd death, on the issue of police brutality. His response has been to issue 2 30-second ads that he's got the money to put out far and wide without making himself available to talk to the media what he thinks about Donald Trump or maybe somewhere we can go as a country. It seems like he would have a unique perspective being an African-American Republican who has roots in Detroit. And yet his response has been, well, we'll just go ahead and put some stuff up on the air and talk to Fox News, and that should be it. It seems like being 14 points down in the most recent poll, he'd want to be in front of every television camera. He'd want to actually be at some rallies and maybe trying to make some kind of impact, trying to get involved in the conversation in some way. Instead, he's hidden in his bunker somewhere.
Oh, no, I would actually agree with you. He should have been out marching. He should have been out speaking as a Republican, faced these same kind of issues himself, I'm sure. He could have been an example for a lot of younger Republicans. He could have encouraged a lot of people to get involved. It's kind of amazing to me when you think Mitt Romney has more political courage to go out and march than somebody who's down 15 points and has nothing but positive gain to get out of showing up.
What do you think of this?
He is a young African-American man, all right? He could be a George Floyd, okay? He's right there. Now, he's had privilege in his life, but his daddy and his uncle didn't. I mean, they went through all sorts of hell to get to the point where he can be right now, where he can be the John James that we know. His campaign blew it. He should have been right on the front lines. If Mitt Romney can march for Black Lives Matter, John James can march for Black Lives Matter. If there can be a Black Lives Matter protest in Howell, Michigan, John James can march for Black Lives Matter. I would have had him right up front. I would have had him speaking the whole thing. I would have said, this is beyond Republican or Democrat. This is a human issue. Boom! Because nobody likes Gary Peters. He's only 14 points up because James is so aligned with Trump. That's the only reason. All right. So I'm sorry. I mean, his campaign just blew it.
This is just a trend, though, that we're seeing, Steve, where they have gotten into this mentality that they're not going to engage with the public. They're only going to communicate through very controlled methods, that they control the message 100% of the time, whether it's paid media, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Fox News. I mean, those are the things that they do, and they don't want to put him in an uncontrolled atmosphere where he might say something that the Democrats will try and exploit later. They're being overly safe with this guy.
George Bush, the young one, our past president, George Bush, he was a boob, but he spoke from the heart and his campaign recovered when he made mistakes. All right. This kid had a chance to do something, and now it's going to be too late because now he's going to look like a Johnny come lately. All right. He's going to look like a Johnny come lately that, oh, I'm doing this just for campaigning now. But he could have done it from the heart before, and he would have been right there with Outlaw, Tommy Outlaw, and John James. He would have been right there, Lewis James. His people are natural fighters. He is the outlier here. They're all over here being fighters, and he's like over here not being a fighter.
Jack, so he does put out some television commercials. That gets you somewhere, I suppose, right? But I think this is one of those instances where not engaging with the public, with not engaging with the media, not answering questions is going to bite you in the rear end, because if you make yourself irrelevant, if you get yourself 15 points down, who's going to pay attention to you when you want the attention?
Well, I don't know how early it is. That's always the game on these things. You can look at it and say it's so early, there's still time to recover. And then there are other times when you get to September and you look back and said, look, it's clear now that what he did back in June is actually costing the race. It's very hard to judge that. It makes no sense to me, the guy not appearing on some of the radio stations, some of this stuff that gives you some local, the local voice that people recognize, you know, when they're driving to work and back and different things like that. So I question the degree to which he's been seemingly in hiding. And I don't know the strategy behind that. You know, I could call it the snowball strategy, because there was that one famous snowball football game between Michigan and Ohio State where Michigan did win by, their strategy was basically to punt every time. But that happens, you know, once every 50 years. So, maybe this will be the once every 50 years for John James. But really, the part that startles me is not, okay, we're going to wait till we get something more positive to jump on that's going on potentially. But the degree to which he's completely punting again and again and again, I frankly don't understand the strategy of that.
In a presidential election year, in order for him to win, he needed to cut. He needs to cut into the African-American turnout for Peters in Detroit. He's not going to do that by sitting on the sidelines and running commercials. He needed to be right up there sweating with everybody else with a megaphone in his hand.
Last thing that I want to touch on, Steve, before we let you go, Brenda Jones and Rashida Tlaib, you're on the front lines on that. How's that race going?
It's going. Tlaib has been out there heading to the protest, doing what I just said John James needed to do. She's doing that. She came out with some teens on Quinter Cut. But Brenda Jones has been there the whole time. Okay. So Brenda Jones is out there as well. Tlaib has come out forward on the whole defunding of the police department, but hasn't really explained herself on what she's really doing there. So that could be an issue. You've still got a massive absentee turnout that's going to happen. The ballots go out in, the 7th or 8th? The ballots will go out in about 20 days, all right? The absentee ballot requests have already gone out, but the ballots are going to start going out around the 28th of June, between the 28th of June and the 6th in Detroit. And that's where all the difference is going to be made right there. You got people fired up to come out and vote. It's going to be a very high turnout election. I still say Jones is going to take it by 5 points right now, unless she stumbles.
All right, well, let's move on to our next interview here with Pat Colbeck. Joining us over Zoom right now is former state senator and gubernatorial candidate Pat Colbeck. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Great to be with you.
Since you left the legislature, you've been the CEO now of something called the Michigan Freedom Center, also Perspective Shifts, and the Michigan Armed Forces Hospitality Organization. You've been involved in quite a lot of stuff. You just can't get yourself out of this political bug, can you? It looks like it's bitten you and it's just grabbed a hold of you.
No, the sad part is I think I swallowed a big honking red pill when I got into Lansing. And believe me, I'd much prefer being on a nice little blue pill diet. And when I see some of the things that are going on up there, I think people need to be informed about what's really driving some of those policies and what options do they have. People are desperate for solutions, and they're looking around for something that makes sense. And frankly, they're not seeing anything that makes sense coming out of Lansing right now.
Why have you been so active since you left the legislature? I mean, you could have gone and retired or gone back to what you were doing before with in the armed forces or doing something with aerospace, but you're staying involved and you're making a lot of commentary. You seem to be kind of still a leader within the conservative movement.
Yeah, and we did build quite a movement, I think, particularly in the wake of the governor run. And I think it harkens back to why I ran for office in the first place. As you know, I came out of the Tea Party movement. For the first 44, 43 years of my life, I was not active at all in politics. And I saw, finally, it was in the 2009, 2010 timeframe that I said, something's wrong with our country. And I wasn't a guy that was particularly engaged in any of this stuff. My family, we never, ever, ever talked about politics. So for me, it was kind of a wake-up call to see that the folks that were running our ship of state were not necessarily looking out for our best interests. So I haven't lost that passion and that realization that the folks that are up there are not always looking out for our best interests. They're all focused in on their best interests. And I think it's important that they're held accountable. And because I've got some knowledge now about how it actually operates up there, I mean, a lot of people term it the swamp. I tend to agree with them. I think it's important that people understand exactly how government really works and what they can do to actually get those elected representatives to start representing them.
Patrick, I wonder if you would talk a little bit about sort of the loggerheads we're at between the legislature and the government right now. What's your takeaway from that? And I guess how would you address it if you were still in the state Senate? Has the Senate been doing what it should be doing right now? Has the legislature been doing what it should be doing right now? Give us your input on that.
Well, first of all, everything that I'm talking about here today, as Kyle, you kind of alluded to at the beginning, I haven't been shy about saying, I haven't been shy at all about saying what I would have done at every moment along the way, and including, John, some of the evaluations of what the Senate and the House is doing versus what they should be doing. So all that is up in social media. This isn't a case of Monday morning quarterbacking or anything like that. This is a case of saying, no, I was going through this just like everybody else was, reading the data that I had available, going off and drawing conclusions based on that. And I should point out that when Governor Whitmer did her initial executive order 2020-21 on March 23rd, I actually encouraged people to go off and comply. I took her at her word that everything that she was talking about, the severity of the situation and what we need to go off and do, I said, please go off and comply with it. If you don't, it's a misdemeanor. Well, I took her at her word, and I started looking, though, at her actions afterwards, and it didn't take more than 24 hours to figure out that the words were just that. There was a lot of political science driving the agenda that I saw, not a lot of medical science, and I was very concerned about that. She immediately went on this whirlwind tour of all of the media outlets to get her name out there in context of what I believe was vice presidential candidate consideration. And meanwhile, all the stuff that she said in her executive order didn't bear out to be accurate. She said she was out there to protect and sustain life, for example. Meanwhile, she's opening up Planned Parenthood and then putting our most vulnerable seniors at risk in regards to these nursing homes. I mean, that's the most vulnerable population at all. She had other alternatives. She could have sent them to a TCF facility or these empty beds that the feds were providing. But she was sending COVID-19 positive patients to nursing homes. It just did not add up. And then you can get into all the arbitrary and capricious stuff that I believe align more with lobbyists, voices such as saying certain types of stores could open up, but other stores had to shut down. I mean, still barbershops, for example. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, we're one of the last states in the nation to go off and allow barbers to go off and conduct their business. And I think that was punitive. And she's essentially using the executive authority that she's been vested in as a political tool not as a tool for safeguarding the best interests of the people of Michigan.
So when she did her first executive order to do the stay-at-home order, is that something as governor that you would have done? Would you have done a stay-at-home order?
No, I think what I said at the time was I wanted to look at a rational, data-driven policy. And what she was doing was not rational. Matter of fact, there's a lot of emotion that went into it. What I would have done is something more akin to what Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota did. And I think if you're looking for a model on how to respond to this, she was on top of the data since day one. Back in January, she had opened up her emergency operations center to deal with this and had taken very proactive stance on it. The other thing I would have done was actually get out in front of the data. You know, it's one of the first things that she did. She stopped communicating data for a little while on infection rates that were going on. And that should have thrown a warning flag for everybody from the beginning. If she's saying that she's going to take a scientific, data-driven approach, which she did repeatedly during that opening press conference on March 23rd, then she should have had a website up there saying, here's what the assumed infection rate is, here's what the assumed hospitalization rate is, correlated to our supply capability in context of how many beds do we have, how many ventilators. And then what is the true fatality rate? And it's not the case fatality rate that everybody's pushing out around 6%. It's the actual true fatality rate. And the only way you can get that is with a statistically sampled infection rate. So I you would have seen a much different policy from me. And that alone, it would have been data driven. And you know me with my engineering background. I mean, I like to look at the numbers. We would have put it out there and made sure that whatever our response was, it was proportional to where the data is.
But you have to social distance, though, right? I mean, you still have to keep 6 feet apart. You got to wear your mask. Would you have kept the businesses open but just stressed the people that you have to do these precautions if you're going to go into a store?
I would have kept the businesses open, and the dictates would have been limited to what I was constitutionally authorized to go off and do. So a lot of her initial executive orders and that she continued on with were in direct violation with our Constitution. So I know she's got a statute, the PA 302 of 1945, that gives her emergency powers on it. Those emergency powers are subject to constitutional authority. They're not unlimited. She's treated them as unlimited. So anything that would have strayed into the bounds of something that would violate somebody's constitutional rights, I would have made the case, a scientific case for why this is a good behavior, but I cannot legally enforce it because I don't have the authority to go off and do that as governor.
But she says that under that approach, you would have lost more lives.
Yeah, well, when you actually look at the data behind lockdowns, and she took the lockdown approach, other states, other governments did not take the lockdown approach. There is no statistical difference between the lockdown states and the non-lockdown states. And that's just the facts of the matter. And that's something we have the convenience of looking back in the rearview mirror now on. But at the time, it was still the policy that I was pushing. You see, one of the first Facebook posts I put out there is that, let's look what everybody else is doing. Let's actually compare the numbers associated with it. And I was looking at Sweden, for example, and looking at South Korea, and you look at South Dakota. And what's going on in those states? Did they have a statistically significantly different fatality rate in those areas and what Michigan has on a per capita basis? No. Sweden actually had more people, but half the deaths. And you can't say they don't have big cities. I mean, Stockholm's not exactly Noggin or something like that. I mean, they got large communities. So, but everything that she was doing, including the order she put out on hydroxychloroquine that I thought was reprehensible, where she actually threatened the removal of licenses from physicians who prescribe hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19 patients, she threatened the removal of their licenses. How many lives did that cost? I mean, we already talked about what's happened with the nursing home fiasco. How many lives did that one thing cost? And I got doctors that are sitting there, they to this day, because of the chill that sent out, they're still reticent to go off and prescribe that, even though they've got study after study showing how effective it is.
So you've spoken a little bit to what Governor Kolbeck would do. What would a Senate Majority Leader Kolbeck or a Speaker Kolbeck have done differently?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't have waited for a month before I came out with a reaction and a plan to go off and address it. Second of all, I would have looked at other alternatives to go off and address some of her actions. I would have held her accountable to what she said she would do. So if she said she was going to do a science data-driven approach, I would harp on her every single day saying, where's the data? How does this data correlate to your policies? And none of that was being done. I definitely wouldn't have formed a commission or a committee, whatever they want to call it, to staff with lobbyists to go off and say, these businesses are good, these businesses are bad. No, our Constitution is pretty clear. It says that our rights and our Constitution, our system of government is meant for our equal benefit. So you can put out some general guidelines and say, this is maybe social distancing makes sense, maybe face masks make sense, highlight what you believe is the science behind all that stuff. But ultimately, if it's not something I don't have the authority to go off and implement, we need to go off and just make the case to the people. That's what they did in South Dakota. They threw a parade for Governor Noem out in South Dakota and in appreciation for her efforts. In Michigan, the parade was a protest. So as Senate Majority Leader, you just got to hold them accountable for what they said they would do. There's other tools, though, too, that I would use, including the Constitution. We got Article 5, Section 2. That provides the legislature the authority to override any executive order within a certain time period. Now, that's designated for reorganizations, but I would assert that when she's going off and designating certain functions of government as essential or non-essential, that's a reclassification or reorganization of government functions. I would have pushed on that early on. And also, I wouldn't have stopped at pushing forward lawsuits that were based on asserting the legislature's rights, because that's what's being done right now. I would be pushing forward lawsuits that protect everybody's rights. Right now, the scope of their lawsuits is just to protect legislative authority. Well, that's fine if the legislature is actually the ones taking care of everybody else's rights, like they're supposed to be doing. They're called representatives for a reason. But if they don't do that, then somebody's got to be looking out for the people. And I think ultimately what we've seen on this whole progression is that it's been the people driving the action now by the government. They're the ones that are standing up and saying, talk to the hand, Governor Whitmer. You don't have this legal authority that you're claiming. You see it exemplified with a gentleman like Carl Mankey, and you've seen the punitive actions being taken by the Attorney General and the governor in response to that.
Well, let's talk about this then, because of the liberty movement that we've seen here at the Capitol, we've gotten into the Black Lives Matter, and I do want to touch on that with you. But before that, we had these liberty movements. The most familiar one to everybody is the one on April 30, where we had folks coming into the gallery with their firearms. I wanted to get your reaction to that protest and what you took away from seeing those scenes of people in the gallery with their firearms, and also maybe some of the other visuals, the noose and the Confederate flags.
All right, let's just dismiss anything that's racist as something that should never be supported in any way, shape, or form. But the guys that were carrying open arms, I've been with them on open carry day. You see them out there every single year on the Capitol. We do an open carry assertion that says we have the right to bear arms, and we and that's not supposed to be infringed upon. By the way, I should also point out that the same people, once we get into the riots and stuff like that, that are calling for defunding police, are the same ones that are pushing for gun control measures that would take away our guns because we don't need them because we can call the police. So there's this little logical do loop that just does not compute in with that crowd, if you know what I mean. So the idea of them going off and asserting their rights on this one, when you got people talking about and introducing legislation to take away their right to bear arms and then using any justification to go off and do so, like a state of emergency, you can understand why they're a little bit concerned about that. Frankly, if our legislature had 1 ounce of the determination around protection of our constitutional rights that those folks that were doing open carry in the Capitol had, we'd be in a much better situation. But the bottom line is, a lot of the folks in Capitol Police, a lot of state police folks that were there, they know these guys. They've seen them every single year. They know they're not trouble. They're just going out there asserting their rights, and frankly, they should have been supported. And I was kind of dismayed by the remarks of Senate Majority Leader Shirky towards those folks. Now, from an optics perspective, we're all in marketing, or we all got that little background around political optics. I understand why it was a bad optic on it. But you know what? Part of that is because we haven't gone off and asserted those constitutional rights effectively for so long that it becomes a shock to people, and it shouldn't be a shock. Everybody should understand. We used to take guns into school just to get trained in firearms, and now it's all, there's a complete paranoia in society. It's kind of irrational, if you will. And a lot of everything that's been done out here, all the reactions have been fairly irrational from my perspective. that serves their interest, frankly. They want irrational responses to it.
Any other one you want to ask, John, before we get into Black Lives Matter?
No, we can go ahead and start on that. That's right. A great topic. So.
Well, actually, on the protest, too, out at the Capitol, I just want to kind of highlight. I mean, there's a bit of hypocrisy that went on right now, right? You saw Gretchen Whitmer going off, and with the Black Lives Matter, she went out to the folks at Black Lives Matter and actually went out without any regard for social distancing. But remember what happened when people were protesting without social distancing out at the Capitol? It was going to be complete pandemonium. She was blaming them for every outbreak that was going to happen in the future, and she was chastising them for doing it.
No, they weren't wearing masks, though. She was wearing a mask, though, Patrick. She was wearing masks.
She took it off for part of the exercise I saw, right? And she didn't have the mask on 100% of the time. And it wasn't even just the mask. It was a social distancing. It was a 5-foot, 6-foot distancing between individuals. You can't say when she was locked in arms that she was actually practicing that social distancing. There's a double standard that people recognize.
Do you think that double standard puts people's health at risk, that people are going to see this, you know, saying one thing, doing another, and so they're going to just ignore the whole thing altogether, thereby increasing their own risk?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of people calling out the hypocrisy for sure, and then using it to justify their behavior. But I'll tell you, I've gone off and researched the science behind this, because if you're going to make policy, you got to make it based on some solid science. I have a paper that I'm working on. It's over 38 pages with all this data from different people. The science on masks, frankly, is inconclusive. I mean, when you're in a operating room, you notice that it's a surgeon wearing the mask, not the patient. So there's a case around saying you wear the mask to prevent transmission. Essentially, the mask is your nice little cover up, if you will, for what mom used to say, which is cover your mouth when you sneeze, right? And the mask covers you so that it limits the projection of any virus in an aerosol form. So it can protect from the transmission, but if you're not carrying it, there's no need for the mask. Now, not everybody knows whether or not you're carrying it or not, so you can say you're asymptomatic, so there's an issue there. But for the folks that are walking around thinking it's going to protect them from the virus, there is absolutely zero evidence to suggest that that's something that's going to help out with. And so what you're seeing right now with the mask versus no mask is really a case of fear-mongering and their approach to it. You've seen it's more by almost political lines than it is by rational lines, if you will. If you watch MSNBC, you're going to be wearing a mask when you go to bed. If you're watching Fox News, you may only wear it when you're going out to the store or something, and you're required to do it by the store owner.
Patrick, I wanted to ask you about the vote that was taken in the Senate last week that would have required police to take implicit bias training, also the mental health screening training. If you were in the Senate still, is that something you would have put a yes vote behind?
I haven't looked at the bills, but in the past, you know, unless something was fair and balanced and politically neutral and look at the situation from all perspectives, I generally would not support it. But if it was something of trying to push a political agenda, and there's a lot of people pushing the social justice movement and the white privilege movement in our classrooms in particular, I get a little concerned about that, because it's only telling one side of the history and one side of the political narrative. So I'm for balanced discussion. That's why I was pushing for free speech in our universities. We don't seem to have that around. And so anything that wasn't pursuing a balanced discussion of facts, I probably would not be supporting.
And then your thoughts on what you're seeing with the protests. What are you taking away from that? Is there any positives that you're taking away from the protests on the George Floyd death?
Well, I think the idea that somebody's life was taken in such a manner as George Floyd's life was taken, by all means, that's something that deserves being protested. And I'm happy to say that the wheels of justice are in work there. He was fired, and he is now facing charges for his actions, that officer. And to the extent that people are just simply protesting those actions, I fully support it. But to the point where this is being used as cover for those who seek what has been termed the fundamental transformation of America by undermining our rule of law, by undermining our system of government, we can't be ignorant to the fact that there are people attempting to do that, and they need to be held accountable. And a lot of times what they do is end up using these protesters that are there out of good conscience to go off and protest something that should be protested, and they're using those folks as their human shields for more nefarious acts. And the ones that are truly seeking the, that are performing this rioting and looting. I mean, when you see some of the videos from the riots, you can't make the case that they're honoring the memory of George Floyd in any way, shape, or form. When they're beating up on a woman who's a shop owner, there's no, with a 2x4, there's no excuse for that. That is not honoring the memory of George Floyd. Martin Luther King made the best example for how to go off and address this. And to the extent that folks are protesting in context of the spirit of kindness but firmness of Martin Luther King, I support it. But to the extent that they're going off and using this as a cover to undermine our system of government, that's an issue. And I'll tell you, I don't think it's coincident that this issue was being used as a flare point right now. We're in a political season. We got the 2020 election coming in front of us. President Trump was winning significant support from blacks across the country because he actually did implement a lot of the policies that politicians on the Democratic side, like President Obama, only talk about. He did criminal justice reform. He got black unemployment was at its lowest mark in history. So he was doing all the things that all the people with that wear a D next to their name always said that they would go off and do, and he actually did it. Well, they couldn't let that stand. So any opportunity they have to drive a wedge between the American people, and let's face it, I mean, I wrote an article back in 2019, at the end of 2019, and the article said, will 2020 be America's finest hour? And I highlighted the conflict that we're in the middle of right now. I'm looking for that leadership, frankly, right now in my own state that's going to sit there and galvanize people and highlight what we need to unify behind. Unfortunately, I'm not seeing that right now. But in that piece, I highlighted what the game plan was going to be for the Democrats in that upcoming election. I highlighted that they're going to use race to go off and divide us. And we always knew they were going to come back and pivot around that issue on it, despite what the facts say. I mean, the low unemployment rate, the fact that we're implementing criminal justice reform, despite all the facts, they're going to go off and try to find something to drive a wedge back. Well, I'm tired of that. I think it's time for us to go back and get unified around some core principles. And it's no mistake that they're attacking law enforcement right now. Because you undermine law enforcement, you undermine the rule of law, you undermine our system of government. And that's what they're trying to unpeel right now. And if you're wondering why I'm being so vocal on this, I am not going to let this stand to whatever extent, whatever limited voice box I have in this capacity as a former senator. I'm going to make sure we use it because I'm not letting these guys get away with it.
Did President Trump miss an opportunity here, though? I mean, could he have handled this in a way that would have inured more to his benefit and I guess maybe more to the country's benefit?
He's got his own style. and I, you know me, I was a state chair for Ted Cruz, and I like Ted's style. I like the way he approached different issues. But I'll tell you, I'm convinced more than ever that President Trump is exactly the man we need for this hour right now because of the way he handles everything. Now, he doesn't handle everything the way I would handle it, but he actually got elected, and I wouldn't have gotten elected in this environment for a variety of reasons. But I had nothing but good things to say about the fact that he has stood in the breach right now against an immense onslaught. In that same paper I was talking about, I highlighted that right after he was assumed into office, they were talking about impeachment and the coup has started. You remember those quotes that came out of some of the operations? You saw what happened with the fake Russian collusion based on the Steele dossier. You saw what happened with the Ukrainian impeachment on it. He has withstood barrage after barrage after barrage. So if I see a couple kinks in the armor every once in a while that I'd like to go off and fill, I'm not going to criticize him on it because he has been a warrior for this country in a way that no other elected official, including, frankly, my friend Ted Cruz would be good, but nowhere near the extent of what Donald Trump has been able to do. So I appreciate everything that he's done, except for the endorsement of Schutte during the governor campaign.
Last, speaking about the governor campaign, Patrick Colbeck, could you see yourself trying this again in 2022, a run for governor?
I get so many people calling me to go off and do that, but we started the show highlighting I'm right now heading operations for the Michigan Armed Forces Hospitality Center. We're 501c3. When I ran for office for the Senate, my wife and I liquidated our retirement savings to go off and do it. So when I came out of the Senate, we didn't really have a lot to fall back on, frankly. And so I've got to find ways to go off and fill that retirement coffer up. And even if I did want to run right now, I wouldn't be able to keep the lights on at home while we did campaign. So this is it's a good theoretical discussion, but frankly, we are not in any financial situation to go off and tackle something like that. I've got a lot of support for doing that, obviously, and I'm honored by that support. But it's really a case where we need to start unifying, not behind any individual, but we need to start unifying behind some core principles again. And one of those principles is the rule of law and our Constitution. And the more we get back unified behind that, I think a lot of the other problems start getting solved themselves.
Well, thank you for your time today. Senator Patrick Kohlbeck, now CEO of the Michigan Freedom Center, Perspectives Shifts, and the Michigan Armed Forces Hospitality Agency. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Hey, great to be with you guys. God bless.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Also, thanks to Steve Hood, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and of course, the boss, John Rurink, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.